we want to thank the people of New Hampshire, right? Do we love the people of New Hampshire? You know, I said it, and I said it even a year ago. I said, I think I'm going to do really well there because I'm here a lot, and it's so beautiful, and I love it so much, and I love the people. And I said, I actually think they like me a lot. And then all of a sudden, we started getting numbers in, and everyone said, how come they like Trump so much? But I have so many friends up here, and they are special, special people. So, New Hampshire, I want to thank you. We love you. We're going to be back a lot. We're not going to forget you. You started it. Remember, you started it.
So, how did it all get started? Let's take a look, shall we? From New Hampshire Public Radio, it's Primarily Politics. I'm Brady Carlson. We're wrapping up the New Hampshire primary in two episodes, sort of like when Guns N' Roses put out those two albums on the same day, or something. Anyway, on this show, we're looking at the Republican primary, starting with the summer of Trump and working all the way to the primary of Trump. We'll also pull back the curtain and share some of our favorite moments from covering the 2016 primary. But first, let's get caught up with the Republican primary in three words. Word number one is winner. Yes, the guy who campaigned on being a winner won. Donald Trump may have gone for big rallies instead of retail politics in his campaign, but he managed to connect to enough voters to finish in first place, voters like Ed Anderson.
I believe that he's got the ability to lead this country out of economic chaos. He's proven that he's an excellent businessman, and I think he knows how to put the right people in the right jobs to bring this country back.
Word number two is runner-up. John Kasich made New Hampshire the center of his campaign, and his theme, positivity. He was making pretty much the only direct appeal to more moderate Republicans and the unaffiliated voters who could vote in the GOP primary. This strategy landed him in second place, which he said was just fine with him.
Maybe, just maybe, we are turning the page on a dark part of American politics, because tonight, the light overcame the darkness of negative campaigns.
Word number three is others. Ted Cruz wasn't able to follow up his victory in Iowa with a win in New Hampshire, but NHPR's Dan Barrick as the Texas senator may not stall out the way that other Iowa winners have done.
Cruz may be an exception to that. I mean, he's been drawing crowds. He has a message that goes beyond the typical evangelical flavor that plays well in Iowa. He'll be part of the story the day after the primary, certainly.
Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio may have hoped for stronger finishes, but both Floridians say they're going to continue on to South Carolina. As for Chris Christie, well, he says he's heading back to New Jersey, though he says you haven't heard the last of him.
You know me. I won't stop talking. I'll continue to speak out about the issues that I care about.
So, how did this all happen, and what does it all mean? I got some answers and a few questions from two people who know the primary inside and out. They're Dante Scala, political scientist at the University of New Hampshire, and Public Radio's political junkie, Ken Rudin.
Dante, you've said the primary can make fools of us all, and anybody who is counting on the way things were going to be a year or two ago certainly is looking at things differently tonight.
I imagine there'll be a lot of hand-wringing over this, that Donald Trump upsets the traditions of the New Hampshire primary. This is the end of the primary as we know it and so forth. And I think people who say that forget the lesson that primaries are democratic with a small d. They're supposed to upset the power of party elites and put power in the hands of rank and file ordinary voters. And that's exactly what's happened this time. I mean, this has been the single most devastating night in a presidential primary for both the Democrats and the Republican Party establishment.
Think of 1996 when Pat Buchanan defeated Bob Dole, who was the clear establishment choice for the nomination. He beat him because he outworked him and he had better issues, and Bob Dole was just not a great candidate. So we shouldn't fault the New Hampshire primary system. We shouldn't fault it at all. We should credit the voters who get a chance to see these candidates up close and make the decision.
Because New Hampshire has sent a message about, you know, the state of politics as we know it today, and that's going to resonate regardless of what happens to the fates of the winners tonight.
Something that you've been saying for a long time, Dante, is the idea that people assumed that eventually an anti-Trump would emerge and that person would be the choice of the anti-Trump voters to coalesce around, but that has not yet happened.
It would be in everyone's interest in the party, if you're a mainstream Republican, for there to be one candidate. But for every individual candidate, they want to be that one, so they have an individual reason to persist. And if they continue that for some time to come, then everyone's going to be worse off if you're a mainstream Republican. But they're all kind of pursuing the idea that they could be the one, and there hasn't been a decisive victory yet, so that one can say to the others, it's time for you to go home.
It's interesting, Ken, in that oftentimes you hear the very conservatives talk about how in past primaries, their votes have been split among a number of candidates when a more mainstream or center-right or establishment choice, for lack of a better term, winds up dominating the field. And yet we almost have a mirror image of that in that we're seeing the so-called establishment track being split among so many governors and senators and candidates like that.
You're absolutely right. Had Marco Rubio followed up on his strong third place showing in Iowa and had a strong showing in New Hampshire, then perhaps the establishment would have found their anti-Trump slash anti-Cruz hero that they could rally around, and maybe the other candidates would have dropped out. Now that Rubio did as poorly as he did, now that John Kasich has become the new, maybe the new Marco Rubio, or at least as of today he is, all those candidates who were supposed to drop out, let the moderates, establishment unite behind one candidate, that's not happening by the collapse of Rubio and the rise of Kasich today.
Ken Rudin, let's hear now from some of what former Florida Governor Jeb Bush had to say tonight at his election night event.
Granted, staters understand that this is a race not to be on the back bench of the United States Senate. We're electing the President of the United States, a person that has to make tough decisions. And I got to share my heart and share my ideas about the future of this country, and I'm so grateful to have that opportunity here in New Hampshire. And along the way, I did a lot of listening and learning, something that I think is important in public leadership. I learned from Missy Cruz, who's right behind me, a woman who is now a leader in the recovery movement here in New Hampshire, which has to spread all across this country. We have an epidemic of addiction in the United States, and what I learned is we can fix it if we all act on our heart to make sure that our families and our loved ones have a second chance. I learned from Eric Olson in the Londonderry Chamber of Commerce, a guy who's expanding his microbrewery business. He's waiting for a stinking stamp inside the Department of the Treasury, a stamp that was created during the Prohibition era. It'll take 6 months. He's already financed the equipment. He's ready to sell more craft beer, but because of the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., he can't do it. I will fix that, I promise you.
Jeb Bush, Dante, in fourth place. So the question is, to use his own slogan, can Jeb fix it?
Well, South Carolina will tell us. I mean, New Hampshire has not been kind to the Bush family for quite a long time, going back to, say, 1980. Well, right. Yeah. I mean, there was that one
George
win.
Bush had the big mo in Iowa and lost it in New Hampshire to Ronald Reagan.
The idea that Jeb Bush would be locked in a battle for third place with 11% of the vote in New Hampshire, and that we would actually see that as, oh, Jeb Bush is performing better than expected tonight, I mean, tells you everything about a campaign that started with supposed shock and awe. He was going to drive everyone from the field.
In fact, I remember that, and this tells you how far we've come, Ken. This campaign was going to start out with the well-funded frontrunner Jeb Bush against the insurgent Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
I thought Jeb Bush was a nominee. There were so many things that went wrong. You know, he talked about his 8 years as governor of Florida. That was a lifetime ago.
What do you see as different about the way that candidates are campaigning, the kind of factors that drive the debate here in New Hampshire? I mean, you saw the winner of the New Hampshire primary tonight, for example, held zero house parties, held town hall meetings in big rally halls and big stadiums and things like that. It's not exactly sort of your quaint New Hampshire tradition, is it?
No. I mean, we've seen that, you know, in past too. I mean, Clinton and Obama in 2008 really skipped right past the town hall meeting, and they were having fairly big rallies fairly early. But this time around, certainly, you know, Trump in particular, national media, national attention, national debates took the spotlight away from New Hampshire. And what was happening in those debates, I mean, when you have 20 million viewers watching a Republican primary and evaluating the candidates for themselves rather than relying on, say, an Iowa straw poll or New Hampshire Republicans at a town hall meeting or a house party to decide, that changes the dynamics. Even though the schedule, the order is the same, when you've got that many Republicans or Democrats tuning in, and cable news networks made big money and big ratings off of the primaries and caucuses in these early debates, that changes things and it nationalizes it to a significant degree.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I think that more voters today looked at Marco Rubio less about his campaigning in New Hampshire and more on less Saturday's debate and his battle back and forth with Chris Christie. I think that affected more voters than the actual retail politicking that he did in New Hampshire.
Yeah, once upon a time, like take Scott Walker, whom you mentioned earlier. Once upon a time, Scott Walker would have run his campaign by spending several months, let's say, in Iowa doing small events. But instead, he was thrust onto the national stage, and he wasn't quite ready for it. And he was one of the first victims of the great attention paid to Donald Trump. But in a bygone era, perhaps, things would have worked out differently. And it's remarkable how quaint it sounds that once upon a time Republicans were known for coronations and Democrats were the ones with the messy primaries. And it was Republicans who always chose the next one in line. You know, the next one in line now is Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. I mean, that's no one's idea of who is supposed to be the next in line. So you really see at this point, and the primaries are exposing how the Republican Party is really at loose ends in a very big way.
That's UNH political scientist Dante Scala and Public Radio's political junkie Ken Rudin. Coming up, that time a candidate for president taught a reporter how to fire a rifle. It's Primarily Politics from New Hampshire Public Radio.
If you are interested in this podcast, you would probably love our new iPhone app. It is all about politics. It is called State of Democracy. Go to the iTunes store right now and search for State of Democracy and download it today.
I'm Brady Carlson. Welcome back. We're wrapping up the Republican presidential primary in this episode of the show. There's also a Democratic episode. This is like a special double issue of a comic book that has tons of guest characters and a special foil embossed cover for collectors. New Hampshire's presidential primary campaign goes on for many, many months. Reporters can spend a lot of time with the candidates and their supporters. Most of what goes on is what you'd expect, speeches, interviews, that sort of thing. But sometimes things can get esoteric, like this moment when former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Bob Smith launched into his Bill Clinton impression at a Ted Cruz event.
Now you listen to me. I'm going to tell you what. I'm going to want you to vote for Hillary because she ain't the right thing for America. But Ted Cruz, he's the man. He brought me a vote. He's good.
One of my favorite moments on the trail was a time when Scott Walker was riding a Harley through all 10 of New Hampshire's counties. Now, the Wisconsin governor regularly took jabs at the media in his campaign speeches, but on this day, he decided to give me a little extra sound for my story.
Go right down there. This is your ultimate sound thing. Right at the end there, put your mic down there for a second. I'm going to rev it, so I'll forewarn you a bit.
I'd have to say my favorite moment on the trail would have to be that time I shot guns with Republican Lindsey Graham. And I'm no gun expert. Actually, this was my first time even holding a gun. But the South Carolina senator showed me the ropes. At first, we started out light with an assault rifle.
Lean into it just a little bit.
Nice and easy. Hold it tight.
Okay, and then flip your safety down. Yep, there you go. Now just pull the trigger when you get there.
Hey! Look at that!
Good work.
Unbelievable.
I must say, I wasn't half bad. But when we turned to the shotgun, my aim was far from on target. I did, however, learn a trick or two. But Graham has already dropped out of the race and will most likely not be remembered for his time in New Hampshire this primary. But I know I won't forget that time Graham taught me how to shoot my first gun.
That's NHPR's Paige Sutherland, pretty much proving that she just about saw it all in the First in the Nation primary trail. Now, that phrase first in the nation means, of course, that there are more primaries to come. And the next big primary is in South Carolina, where the campaign can be quite different. I talked with the reporter Andy Shane of the state newspaper in South Carolina about where the GOP race may be headed as it moves to his state. As one of the next in line, what do you make of what's happened here?
You know, obviously not much of a surprise. I think this is what we were expecting based on what we'd been seeing in the polls. Donald Trump, just like he was in New Hampshire, has been leading down here for quite some time. I kind of made the joke that, you know, we're here in SEC country, that he's been leading a month before the football season and he's still leading a week after the Super Bowl. You know, at this point, it's going to take a lot, I think, to knock him off the top. He's got a 16-point lead. We haven't had as much polling here as you've had in New Hampshire and in Iowa, but at the moment it's tough to see how anyone's cracked into his lead. Maybe Ted Cruz has a little bit with the efforts that he has done with targeting, but at this point he's had a commanding edge in South Carolina. And then Cruz is next. We're a social conservative state. 60% of our Republican voters identify themselves as evangelical, just like they do in Iowa. So this will be a place where Cruz should do well. And then in third has been Marco Rubio, who's really come across for a while as the establishment or the anti-Trump, anti-Cruz choice.
Now, some of the candidates who you're describing have had resources in place in South Carolina and other states as we go further into the nominating calendar. There are other candidates, for example, like John Kasich. What kind of resources do those candidates who have put so much of their effort here have going forward into South Carolina?
John Kasich, who, you know, of course, has done very well in New Hampshire, doesn't have much of an operation here in South Carolina. He's really building from ground zero, literally, to do things. His political action committee did say they're starting to start a ground game here. He is, you know, had some presence, but take away Chris Christie, who, of course, basically seemed to live in New Hampshire for the past few months. John Kasich is the candidate who's had the fewest visits just ahead of Christie here in the state of South Carolina. Essentially, he's going to have to really take a lot of momentum out of the second place finish in New Hampshire to have any chance in South Carolina. He's basically been polling at 2%. He's never gotten any more than 4% in a poll in South Carolina. So he's not really been a presence here.
That's reporter Andy Shane of the state newspaper in South Carolina looking to the future. Finally, just when we thought we'd seen everything that could possibly happen in a New Hampshire presidential primary, just when even the most diehard primary lover said, "No more, please, I'm good," then this happened. That is the sound of a 600-pound pig showing up at the polls in Pelham, New Hampshire. Or is it Pelham? See what I did there? And that really is it for this primary and for this show. We had help with this show from Sarah Ashworth, Peter Biello, Dan Colgan, Ellen Grimm, Rebecca Lavoie, Andrew Perella, Taylor Quimby, Michael Rafke, and Josh Rogers. If you'd like to enjoy the primary all over again, check out our past episodes on iTunes, Audioboom, and NHPR.org. If you enjoyed the show, leave a review on any of those sites or let me know on Twitter. I'm at Brady Carlson, all one word. Thanks for listening to Primarily Politics. And remember, primary 2016 may be over, but primary 2020 has just begun.